Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. This is the third talk of 2006 Rains Retreat. So 2 weeks have gone past, and in 2 weeks that we've settled in, some of you come across brick walls, some of you have got through those brick walls, some of you are still banging your head against a brick wall. This is why we have talks here, to make your head much lighter, so you can find out the ways around the brick walls of the Rains Retreat. And thereby you can get your very, very best out of this very amazing period, where we have so few responsibilities, so few distractions, and this is as perfect as it gets to be able to develop the Eightfold Path and make huge strides towards Nibbana. But this evening I wanted to talk about the four ways to practice to Nibbana. And you may relate to one of these four ways. There's the fast way with lots of happiness. There's a fast way with lots of suffering. There's the slow way with happiness. And there's the slow way with lots of suffering. And I think a lot of people, they'd like to do the first way, the fast way with lots of happiness. But many of you end up doing the slow way with lots of suffering. I don't know why you do that. But at least it's a way. And of course, there is a fifth option there, which is no way. And people think that if they give up and do no way at all, then it's no way with happiness. But there's only one other option, the fifth way, is no way with even more suffering. So I don't think if one stops practicing, though I can have this fantasy way of no way but lots of happiness. Because even what I just said there, it can't be that. It's no way can you have happiness when you haven't got a path. So because of that, that one has to stick with one of those four. That's the only options open. Unless you want to just decide to give up and just go back into that world. And many of you have had enough experience of that. That's why you came in the first place. And if you haven't had enough experience of that, you can just borrow a newspaper. You can just sit next to me when people come and tell the problems. You can actually find out what people really are up to in their life and why people want to come here in the first place and why this place is so well supported. There's a reason for this. And because a lot of people, they would just think, wow, if only I could come here and do this and try and find a way out of the meaningless of life, of the suffering and the disappointments. Never think that you can somehow sort of etch a path in that world outside where you won't meet with even more suffering, with more frustrations, with more disappointments, with more pain, with more old age and suffering and rejection and loneliness. Because this is the best that we can possibly have in a monastery. So don't think the alternative is a happy path when you're not really striving at all for Nibbana. So understanding that, you've got four choices, and that's all you have. Now the fascinating thing, the Buddha didn't just say about just the four choices, he said why you have a slow path or a fast path. And the slow path or the fast path is on dependence upon the strength of the five indriyas. And those five indriyas, you know, the faith, the energy, the mindfulness, the stillness and the wisdom. And the reason why it's suffering, or whether it's happy, is the strength of the defilements. Just how much lust you have, and sensuary desire. How much ill will you have. How much stupidity you have. And that's, you know, the reason why it's painful. And of all those three, those kilesas, those defilements, the root one is the stupidity. It's a stupid person who creates a lot of suffering in their life. And remember, the Buddha said there's those options there. And it's only the ones who have a lot of suffering in their life. So it's only the stupid ones who have a lot of suffering in their practice. So if you really think about it, if you want to sort of be a monk who pushes through pain and just confronts suffering and just don't go the happy path, it must mean you have a lot of stupidity in there somewhere. It's only the stupid ones just have to experience so much pain. That's what the Buddha said. So understanding there's another path, this is why that for a long time I just taught that happy path. And to do that happy path, the delusion bit is overcome just by doing some wise reflections on things like anatta. When you understand and look at your meditation, your path as anatta, it's not up to me. I'm not in control of this path. It's not my business. It's just something which happens in spite of me. And so all of this idea that I'm hopeless, I'm brilliant, I can really do this, so I can't do this, that I'm having a good time, I'm having a bad time. Any time that we should have this word I which comes up in the judgment of your practice, you are being stupid. And that's why, you know, I've hammered on this point for so long in the last few years, that, you know, you aren't doing this. As soon as you get out of the way, the quicker the path works. And here we're saying the happier the path is. Because the delusion of a self, of a controller, of a me in charge of my practice, who's deciding what to do and how to do it, you can understand what that leads to. Whenever there is an I, there is a controller. Whenever there's a controller, there's will. Whenever there's will, there's eventually frustration when it does not work according to the way you want it to. And that frustration just leads you into sort of judging yourself as being hopeless. I can't do this. And you give up. All because you started it off thinking that you were driving this vehicle in the first place. So don't be stupid and cause suffering for yourself. All you do is sit down and get out of the way. Even just listening now, just listen and get out of the way. Just you eat, you get out of the way. So it's not a self doing this anymore. It's not a me, it's not an ego. You're not doing this to get sort of what they used to call brownie points or badges. I was used to be a, never made it to the scouts, I saw through that very quickly, but I was a cub and used to get all these badges for lighting fires. You even got a badge for being able to make a cup of tea. And sometimes people still do that. They want a, like a badge in the monastery. A badge for being able to do the Patimokkha. A badge for knowing Pali. And a badge for getting jhanas. But that just makes up this sense of self and this ego. So just doing a little bit of reflection. It's not me, not mine, not a self. It doesn't belong to me. Or just as we chanted today in the fire sermon, all of this meditation business, all of the stuff which I'm experiencing now and forever through the six senses, is on fire. With what? With the stupidity. With lust, with ill will. That's the nature of the five senses, it says. They're on fire with these things. It doesn't say actually put out the fire, as much as you just get fed up with these things. You get nibbida towards them. And because you get nibbida towards them, you just, nothing to do with me anymore. I've had enough of these sights, smells, tastes, touches, sounds, and mind objects. And when you look at all the stuff you attach to, all the stuff which you make judgments on, it's all part of those six senses. So you just abandon the whole lot. That's what nibbida means. You just, they say it's just like a sore on your body. You just disgust, rejection of it. You just don't want anything to do with it anymore. If you develop the nibbida towards those things, that's a good way of understanding just non-self. It doesn't belong to me, nothing to do with me. What would I sort of hold on to such things for? And just imagine and take that, you know, logically to its end. Everything which you can experience, which you can know is part of the six senses. So you're rejecting the whole lot. There's nothing to do with you. When you reject the whole lot, And how on earth are you going to judge, you know, your meditation? Isn't your meditation just objects, things to be felt through the eye, things to be heard through the ear, things to be smelt through the nose, things to be tasted through the tongue, things to be felt through the body, things to be known through the mind? Isn't that just what your meditation is? And the Buddha said these are all on fire. And the way to overcome that is just throw the whole lot away. Nibbida towards it. Now this is how we can practice. And if we practice like that, we are lessening the defilements, the kilesas, straight away. And the Buddha said that if you have a lessening of those defilements, especially the delusion, then you don't have suffering in your practice. You have a happy path. If you can't do it with wisdom, by overcoming your delusion, at least you can do it by suppressing your other two aspects, you know, the ill will and the lust, the desire, the sensory desire. So you suppress those things. You say, what do I want? That's the desire business. And you've heard me say that that's a mantra you can keep asking yourself whenever you get any suffering. What do I really want anyway? And when you find out what you want, then you say, so what? Where does that lead? Where would it get me? So what do you really want? Now for years, as a stupid young monk, I wanted to get some food, you know, which I used to eat, fish and chips. And I remember the 7 years as a monk, and then I went to visit my family for the first time after 7 years. You never saw a potato, let alone a chip, in northeast Thailand. All you saw was rice and frogs. And I remember clearly, this is my karma, just the way that Mara just makes fun of you. I went into my mother's apartment for the first time after 7 years. And in those days, when I was young, you used to have chips with every meal. That was just what you did. A working class family in London. And I still remember the saucepan which my mother used to fry the chips in. And you don't change these for 20, 30 years. They're caked with oil. And that gives them the special flavour. And there was the old chip pan which I remember from my youth. Still on the gas stove. And you can imagine what I felt when as soon as I walked in, 5 minutes later, and you don't know why, it must have been Mara got in control of my mother. She said, you know, for months I've been wanting to throw this out. And she took it up, wrapped it in newspaper and put it in the bin. In front of my eyes. I've been waiting 7 years. And she has to choose this moment for throwing away the chip pan. And that was suffering. Simply because of craving and desire. It was great, I think, great that Mara did that, because I may have been a deva did that, just to teach me a lesson. But of course, later on, when you do get these things, it's so what? It's a big deal, it's nothing much. First time I got fresh fish and chips. I remember that occasion too. I had to come here to Australia, so it must have been about 10 years as a monk. I went to a funeral service, and on the way back, it's one of these funeral services where you have to get a meal outside because it's just the wrong time. You can't get back in time, you can't have a meal before you leave. And so this was my big chance to get fish and chips. So I went, found a fish and chip shop, and we got these fish and chips, and had a stomachache afterwards for days. And so that really started teaching me a lesson. All these craving business, when you get it, so what? Even if you do enjoy it, so what? Is that really worthwhile, just wasting all this energy, this mental energy for? Is a cup of coffee really the fun bit? So you have a conversation with your friends. You watch a movie or whatever else you do. In the end, you look afterwards and say, so what? Was that really worth anything? So if you have that investigative mind, you can very easily cut through so much of the sensory desires. And after a while you say, what do I want anymore? And you're lessening the wanting. And the more you lessen the wanting, the more you're lessening the suffering of the path, the more you have a happy path. The more you want, the more painful is the practice. And that's not just for sensory pleasures. It also works for even the mental pleasures as well. But this is a great problem in a retreat such as this. When I start talking about beautiful breasts and nimittas and jhanas, and they are there, they are real. But because of monks' stupidity, they start wanting them. And because they want them, they want to get somewhere in their meditation, they want to get still and peaceful. That wanting, that craving, causes an unhappy path, a suffering in the rains retreat. So one lets go of that wanting. That doesn't mean that one just drifts rudderless through the 3 months of the rains retreat. Just sleeping, reading novels, talking with your friends, finding projects to do, little things which, you know, waste your time. So frittering away the time is not what I mean by letting go. If you really understand what you mean, it's not allowing that energy to go into other sensory objects. It's not saying, yeah, I'm going to let go of meditation, but attached to all this other stuff which you do. You let go of everything. It's one of the troubles when we talk about letting go. People let go of the wrong things, and they attach to old habits instead. Let go of the old habits first, and then let go of the mind. Don't do it the other way around. Let go of the old habits first, and then let go of the mind. Instead of just letting go of the mind and just getting off into the old habits. And if you understand what I mean there, you let go of the old habits, and then when you sit down, you let go of the mind. No wanting. The result of that is stillness. Even today, these people who came to visit from, they're supposed to be disadvantaged women. Even today, I just did the simile of holding up the cup and say, I'm trying to make this still, and I can't do it. And then I said, how can I make this still? And even people never meditated before, so it's simple, put it down. And I put the cup on the floor. That's interesting, it's a great simile this, because every time I put the cup down on the floor, the tea in the mug actually moves more than when I'm holding it. It's the same when you let go. When you let go when you're sitting down, sometimes the mind moves more, it thinks more, it's more restless. But wait. Because once you've let go of the cup and you put it on the floor, it's only a matter of time. And the movement, the vibrations in the cup get less and less and less. And the tea settles down until it's absolutely still. More still than you could ever hold it still. I love this simile because it actually shows what happens when you really make this letting go happen. If you do it properly, in the same way you take a cup of tea and you put it on the ground and leave it alone. The same way you take your mind and you put it down. And this controller bit, this hand which always is interfering and messing up the process, your wisdom sees that, it discerns that, and just takes it away. So your mind is truly let go. Just like the Buddha said, it's just these are mind consciousness, objects of mind. Things that we felt because of mind. And all of these, you have nibbida towards you, just leave them alone, nothing to do with me. Now this is the path which the Buddha taught. And when you can do this without any raga, without any desire, you'll find this a path of no suffering or less suffering. It becomes a happy path. And if you find that difficult, then what's this ill will business? The other of the third kilesas. And of course, in a monastery such as this, people usually get on really well together. We've actually got this pretty well down in this monastery. Most people who come here just notice just how harmonious we all are, how we're all friends. We very rarely have like arguments or shouting matches, but that's not the way of all monasteries. One example which I will give you. This is, many of you know, Paul Breiter. I don't think you'll mind me telling the story. Because we have a photograph up in, actually I just lent it to somebody today, the photograph of all these monks when I give it to the lay people and say, which one is me? sitting about on the ground just 2 miles away from Ajahn Chah is Paul Breiter. And I think that this must have happened just a couple of months before that photograph was taken at the Pawarana ceremony, invitation ceremony, where the monks meet together and we say, whatever faults which I have by body, speech and mind, which you may have seen, I give you invitation, my fellow monks, to advise me on those faults, to let me know, because I may have seen you may have seen something I haven't noticed in me. And I remember just after this Pawarana ceremony, I was a young monk, really inspired, and Paul Breiter came out and said to Prabhakara, yeah, you've invited me to tell you off, and so I'm going to tell you now you're a shit ass. That's what he said. And that's not what the Pawarana ceremony means. That's a stupid thing to say. But that's actually how it was in some of those monasteries, where people sometimes were at each other's throats, even though they're not supposed to be, because they were young monks and they had defilements. And they had anger sometimes and jealousies. And we're in a great monastery here that doesn't really happen so much here. And people are usually generally kind to each other. Although we have had shouting matches here before, which many of you can remember. It's very embarrassing we have those. But it's great we don't have them now. So the negativity, the ill will, is not such a problem in this monastery, but what is a problem is ill will towards oneself, ill will towards one's practice, which is still a huge problem. When you look at how you regard yourself, do you regard yourself with loving kindness, or are you always beating yourself up inside? I'm not good enough, I can't meditate. Maybe these other monks can get jhanas, but not me. Maybe these other monks can meditate for hours, but not me. I'm not going very well. 2 weeks have gone, I've actually gone backwards. I used to meditate more during the coffee club times than now. You get really bad on yourself. And if you do things like that, you're just making suffering for yourself. So it's just ill will towards yourself. And if it's not ill will towards yourself, you transfer that sort of ego thing of success and failure, you know, onto your meditation practice. It's not my fault. It's not Ajahn Brahm's fault. It's not the Buddha's fault. It's this bloody breath fault or meditation. I'm fed up. I'm sick to the teeth with meditation. You have ill will towards even sitting on your cushion. So be careful of any ill will whatsoever. Whether it's ill will towards your meditation cushion, ill will towards your body because it's not as fit and healthy and pain-free as it was before, ill will towards the breath, ill will towards the teacher, or ill will towards the path. Because every time you badmouth in your mind these things, you are creating suffering in your path to Nibbana. This is what the Buddha said, these three defilements are what is the cause for a path with suffering. And the more you can abandon those defilements, the happier the path is. And I've got compassion for each one of you, I don't want to see you guys suffering. And of course if you are suffering, you come to my heart and cause me problems. So maybe I'm selfish, but I like to really encourage you all to let go of your stupidity, your desire and your ill will, if nothing more, to give me a good time. But really, it's so you can have a good time as well. And so you can have a happy path to Nibbana. And so check out those defilements. You know, are you really understanding what's going on? So use your rational mind. You know, use your investigative mind. Read some of the suttas and find out if, you know, the sorts of things which I'm saying are sort of valid or not. Now lessen your greed, your sensory desire. You don't have to throw it all away right now, but you can at least lessen it. All your wanting and socializing and talking. But certainly also work on your ill will. Because sometimes they can't see the suffering in desire. Because when they desire something and they get what they want, they get a buzz out of that. But ill will is always suffering at the beginning, middle and end. So when you have ill will towards something, please knock that on the head. Just don't allow yourself to get into that. Don't get negative towards the place, to the meditation object, to the path, to the other monks here, to me or to anything. Because if you do, you're just making your path more suffering and more difficult. And so when you lessen those defilements, you know, through mindfulness and through reflection, you find that the path becomes happier. And it's not just for having a good time, because the happiness energizes the mind and energizes the practice. People who are not having a good time because of those three defilements, greed, hatred and delusion or stupidity, you find they do tend to waste time. They do tend to sort of, you know, try and find ways of wasting the moments. Sleeping a lot, maybe reading, finding some project, going to see their friends, just walking aimlessly around. Why do they do that? It's because they're suffering. If you've got happiness, you find that the mind wants to engage in the practice. The happy people meditate more. That's just the rule of thumb. Because you want to. As the Buddha kept on saying, Sukhino Chittang Samadhiyati, from happiness the mind wants to meditate and gets samadhi. And so it's important to develop that happy mind by lessening the defilements. You don't create a happy mind by following the defilements. That's the point of what I'm saying here. The more you increase your stupidity and thickness, the more you increase and follow your cravings, and the more that you cultivate negativity and ill will, just the more suffering you're making for yourself, and just the slower the path becomes. It's just a stupid way of practicing. So use your reflection, use your mindfulness, use your intelligence to cut those defilements down. And you'll find that the mind energizes and the path gets faster. Because the speed of the path is the strength of the indriyas. And the first one of those is like faith. Confidence that this can be done and you can do it. It's been a great fight for me to convince people that you can get jhanas. And sometimes people still don't believe that they can get jhanas. Even here, people think, oh, he goes again on the jhana bandwagon. And I've been trying for 3 years, 10 years, 20 years, still haven't got jhanas yet. I think it was Fennel Anuruddha. You know, the sort of this great monk with all these psychic powers who was at the Mahaparinirvana of the Buddha. And he was the one who could actually see what was going on when the Buddha was about to pass away. He said, no, he's not passing away yet. He's just in Nirodha Samapatti. This is a great monk. Venerable Anuruddha, just one of the leading monks in the time of the Buddha. And I think I remember reading in his story, I think it took him about 16 or 17 years to break through. When it says in the suttas, those of you who read the suttas, they say, and this young man of good family, he went forth and then secluded, ardent, and in no long time he became another arahat. In the suttas, in no long time sometimes means 16, 20 years. When you look upon the time scale in the whole vast expanse of samsara, of, you know, so many lives, and each universe cycle, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of millions of years old. And you think, like, 16 and 17 years is not that much, which is why they say in no long time. So I think I'm the only one in this monastery who's been here long enough to actually to call in no long time. You guys haven't even got to in no long time yet. You just come, you've just started, even though you've been here 10 years. So understand that you've got to give the whole path that time for it to work. It's not something you can just think, okay, I'm going to get enlightened this range retreat, this is the one. And if I don't get enlightened this range retreat, I don't get meditation this retreat, I'm off. Don't think like that. Give it the time which it's needed. This is a huge undertaking. And have the faith that if you keep on practicing in the path, you're going to get there. And also the knowledge that if you're not practicing, if you're not sitting and meditating, you're not walking meditation, you're not trying to lessen your defilements, you're not being mindful, you understand, then you're wasting time. So if you put forth the effort to practice the path, you know it's going to work. Which brings to the second of the indriyas, which is energy. And I love this word because it's not effort, it's energy. Because the effort sometimes people confuse, and sometimes many of you are still confused. I was confused. Remember one of the first questions which I asked Ajahn Sumedho in public, because he was my first teacher as a monk, maybe 1 year. Any questions? Yeah, what is this effort business? Because Ajahn Chah keeps on saying letting go, but I'm supposed to put forth effort according to the four right efforts of the Buddha. What actually is it? Explain it to me. And many of you are still confused about, you know, what is the role of effort, because you hear me keep on saying, just sit down and let go, don't do anything. And it's still confusing for many of you. And the answer is, in that saying of the Buddha, what Ajahn Chah kept on saying, that if you want to have physical energy, yes, you have to put forth effort and exercise, which takes willpower. Willpower to do push-ups or to do stretches or to walk and run around the monastery. But he said for mental power, mental energy, you have to cultivate stillness. And that's the key to understanding what energy is in terms of the indriyas. It's not the physical energy we're talking about here, it's the mental energy. And that mental energy only comes from stillness. And stillness is what is destroyed by what you think of as effort. Every time you put forth effort, because it really is coming from a self, from me, you actually agitate whatever stillness is there. And you destroy it. That's why we talk so much about letting go of that which agitates the natural stillness of the mind. To find out what stillness is, and just to see the mind just interfere, try and control, try and grab onto it and own that stillness and thereby destroy it. All those things, grabbing onto, owning, grasping, that is the wrong effort, which doesn't create wholesome states of mind, but actually creates the unwholesome ones. Once you see that point, with your wisdom, you understand why these defilements not only cause suffering, but they also stop, or rather slow down the progress of this path. You have to have enough faith to try that first of all, and then to see it. It's from stillness you get the energy of the mind, the virya. I think I gave a talk a long time ago. I made a connection between the word viro in Pali, which is like the hero, and virya, which actually almost means like of the hero. Heroic. And this is actually what it means. Like a hero in sort of ancient Indian culture was someone who would give his life for the cause, would never think of his body, would take the arrows and the spears and the swords. That was the hero. And this is what we have to do in our meditation to get the heroic effort. We have to not just let go of our body and abandon our body. We have to do something even more and abandon our mind. To allow our mind to die, to disappear, to get cut to pieces by this beautiful path of deep meditation. It's that heroic energy which is required, not the energy which is selfish, building up the self and getting more attainments, and building up the will and seeing how strong and powerful and how many achievements I have. But it's the one which abandons all of that the true hero who allows his body to be sliced to pieces. You allow your will to be sliced away until it completely vanishes. And that's the energy, because when the will disappears, the mind awakens. It awakens because it's energized. In the same way that if you have a strong cup of coffee in the morning, your sloth and torpor disappears, and your mind is alert, it's awake, it's energized. The same way that when you have stillness, the mind becomes awake and energized. Certainly I've noticed my own mind in just the 2 weeks we've been practicing here, because I haven't needed to run around so much. My workload has been lessened quite considerably and had more chance to develop stillness in my cave. I notice the energies of my mind are really increasing. The mind is wakening. It's becoming sharp and just seeing much more. And with that energy also comes a happiness. So this is another way of developing the happy path, but the fast path. The happiness is empowering the mind. Now that's what energy does. And there is a way of looking at these indriyas where one leads to the other. From faith, in stillness, you develop the energy. And when you have the energetic mind, powered by stillness, you get to understand what mindfulness truly is. As a young monk in the forest monasteries, that was one of the main practices, just be mindful. And mindfulness was even more important as your practice than samadhi. And it seems that's all we were doing, day in, day out, trying to be more awake, more mindful, more alert. You tried, and sometimes you failed. But at least mindfulness was important. Now I'm emphasizing mindfulness as well. But to be mindful, it took years before someone would actually explain what it meant. I don't actually if they really did explain what it meant. You discovered it for yourself through the power of samadhi. Because when you were still and the mind was energized, your mindfulness went to another level of intensity, of sharpness. You could feel more, you could see more, you could know more. And you know that I've had very deep samadhi states, and when you come out afterwards, you just realize, not through theory, but as direct experience, just how powerful mindfulness can be. And sometimes you compare it to the mindfulness, just, you know, when you come back, say, from Nolamara from the weekend. Sure, you're mindful, but you're not truly awake. It's just your mindfulness is very, very dull. You compare that with mindfulness after deep samadhi, and wow, there's a world of difference. And you know from those experiences the mindfulness which is required, you know, for really developing deep insight and finding out what the heck is going on inside your mind. Once you develop that type of mindfulness, you can see all these things which I'm teaching you now is just so clearly and so true. You just see the stupidity of those defilements. Why the heck would you want to have these sensory objects? And so sometimes when you think about them, maybe in the Dharma hall here, just listening to a talk, you say, yeah, that's right, why do I want just this extra piece of food or a girl or a cup of coffee or just to talk to my friend? I don't want that at all. But you keep forgetting. The mind gets dull and goes into its own habits. And it gets into negativity and the whole mind goes into this spiral downwards away from Dhamma. And that's just the path of suffering and a slow journey to Nibbana. Once you have an energetic mind built of stillness, when the defilements, the kilesas have been subdued, it's amazing just how powerful your mind can be. How much it can see. Even when you come out in the morning, you can see the cloud shapes, just how incredibly beautiful they are, just after a rain. In the early morning when the The sun is beginning to shine in the eastern horizon. And you get so much delight when the mind is awake. Just like the water dripping from the leaves after the rainstorm. Everything becomes more alive. Everything becomes more rich. The whole world becomes deeper. You understand what mindfulness is doing. You understand why people have the suffering path and the long path. Because they go through the monastic life. Not half asleep, but 90% asleep. The senses are just so dull. And you try and wake them up. Try to sit still, don't do anything, but they just can't see it. And so they keep struggling and use up more energy and they get more dull. And they say, I can't meditate. I'm not having any fun. This is hopeless. Simply because they haven't woken, they don't know what they're talking about, literally. Completely in the power of dullness, of a lack of mindfulness. Sometimes people think they are mindful, but they haven't really experienced the depth and power of mindfulness. Once you develop that still energy, the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, more delightful, you see more. And imagine you have that type of mindfulness, you say, okay, let's watch the breath now. Because you can see more deeply into things, and what you see is more beautiful. When you watch the breath, you can see it very clearly. And it's beautiful to watch. Straight away you go into beautiful breath state of meditation. Simply because you've raised your mental energy through stillness. And again, this is one of the most powerful teachings I can give you. For a happy and fast path to Nibbana. To get enough still energy that mindfulness becomes fully established and powerful. At least powerful enough to start having fun on the path. Dull people are the ones who have the pain and suffering and confusion. When the mind wakes up, I'm not talking about Buddhahood yet, but waking up enough for the energy to start flowing, then you understand the power of the stillness, understand what sati is as an indriya, as a power which pushes you forward. And of course you know what happens next. Because of that energy, that power, that joy, which makes you look at the world in a positive way. The rain is beautiful. Sort of the kangaroo shit is aromatic. Whatever it is, you just tend to see the beauty in things. Simply because your mind is energized. When your mind is dull, everything is depressing. Even your favorite food is depressing. You can't taste it. Simply because your mind has got no energy. So when you energize your mind, you get this happiness. And when you energize your mind, have happiness, have this beautiful mindfulness, then you can actually get into deep meditation very simply. So you don't enter the jhanas just because you say, right, I'm going to sit down now, I'm going to do it, I'm going to crack it. You have to understand the path and how it all works. Create enough stillness, not craving. See how still you can be. You sit down, I'm going to try and do nothing. Remember as a kid, you used to play games in school of being statues. Seeing how still we could stand and who could stand still the longest. This is what you do with your mind. You play statues with your mind. See how still your mind can be without it moving. You know when it moves, because it usually moves into thinking, into choosing. But you hold it like a statue, not moving. See how still that mind can be. No commenting, no judging, no getting lost in the perceptions of good or bad, I like, I don't like. The whole thing, just letting go. Like a statue, the mind stands still. When you get into that type of stillness, beyond thought, beyond movement, the mind does start to waken up. The energy comes. The joy comes. You find you can do samadhi. You do samadhi when you're still, when you get out of the way. It just happens. And you enjoy these beautiful states of mind which the Buddha talked about. And then you come up afterwards and you tell me, yeah, you were right, Ajahn Brahm, I can do it. Of course you can do it. Anyone can do it if they just follow the instructions and not be so pig-headed and stubborn. How to have the faith, first of all. And once you start getting into samadhi practice, then you're on the fast path, fast lane to nibbana, an incredibly happy path as well. Samadhi, as everybody knows, even the Buddha said it, it really starts to suppress big time all your cravings and your lust and your desire for food or movies or whatever. Because you have a joy which is far more superior. Tastes better, more pleasurable, lasts longer. And when you get into that degree of joy in the mind, my job as a teacher is basically over. Then, you know, you're on the way. Nothing can stop you. You just love meditating, you get into deeper and deeper stages. And I enjoy it when people come and tell me about what they're doing and what's happening. You're just having a great deal of fun with your mind. You're a real bhikkhu. You're a monk who's doing monk things. You're going into the land of the Aryas, where you enjoy the bliss of the mind and the amazing things which it can do. You're finding out what Buddhism really is about. And all the stuff you read about in the old suttas, you find you're doing exactly the same. And that really inspires you. It makes this whole thing come alive. It's not some ancient teaching that could only be done 26 centuries ago. It's akalika, timeless, and it's being done now. You're doing it. And that really brings enormous energy. And the faith just goes to another level. Simply because you followed the instructions. And you look back and it's nothing to do with the raw material. You know, what you came into this monastery with. Because this path is immaterial, is doesn't matter what the raw material is. It can take prostitutes, it can take serial killers, it can take crazy people like Patachara. Hunchbacks, street sweepers, kings, there's every type of raw material you see in the suttas. They kept on going, followed the instructions, and they became Sotapannas, Sakadagamis, Anagamis, Arahats. It's a beautiful path. If you've gone far enough along, you can see there's nothing to do with the raw material. It's everything to do just with the path, and you continue to walk on that path. So when you get to the samadhi stage, then you're on sort of the final laps. And it's great when you're on those final laps because you're an inspiring monk. You're actually doing it, and people see that. It exudes from you. You're a samadhi junkie, and people love seeing that. You're one who just wants to stay by themselves as much as possible. Because you enjoy solitude, both physical solitude and mental solitude, where the mind separates itself completely from the world of the five senses. It goes into the bliss states of the mind. And that can happen to any one of you during this rains retreat. It's there for you. So have enough confidence and faith. But also understand how to do it. Once you develop those deep meditations, you get wisdom. It's natural. Just like when you plant a mango tree, eventually the mango forms and falls. So like samadhi is like planting a mango tree, and the wisdom is like the fruit which falls. You don't have to sort of do anything and say, now I planted a tree, now it's very, very big. How do I make it bear fruit? It's the nature of a tree. Once it's mature, to actually to have blossoms, get to whatever it is, not fertilized, but cross-pollinated, and then bear the fruits. In the same way that when you get deep meditation, it's only a matter of time before the fruit of wisdom starts to form And you see things as they truly are. You get all these attainments you see in the books. You never think that they're yours. It's just what happens, that's all. You understand the path and how the whole thing works. And you know why the Buddha said there are four types of paths: a slow path with lots of suffering. And you may sort of look back and say, yeah, you had a bit of suffering. Why was that? Because my stupidity, mostly. I mean, and that makes this craving and this ill will, this negativity. And you see that that was a complete waste of time, literally. You just made big stick for your own back. You picked up a burden which had nothing to do with you and carried it round and round in circles, never got anywhere. Craving and ill will and the stupidity. When you actually see that at the end of the, towards the end of the path, you understand why people suffer. When you don't have to. It's not necessary. So if you think, oh, no pain, no gain, I've got to suffer and really push through suffering to get to enlightenment, always think that that's only because people have got defilements, strong defilements. That's why they have to suffer. So lessen your defilements and it's a much happier rains retreat. And the fast you'll see with that wisdom, just because you never had enough faith to follow the teachings as they were taught. You want to do it your own way. And you look at yourself, I was just a stupid Putichana. Why did I want to do it my way when I knew I didn't know what I was doing? Why did I believe in my thoughts and my judgments and assessments of what's possible and what's not possible? Why did I believe in me so much? And you see, that's just such a stupid thing. So you have faith in the Buddha's teachings. And that's enough to make it a fast path. The more faith you have, the faster it's going to be. The more you believe in delusion, the slower it's going to be. Sometimes so slow you give up, disrobe in this life, and then have to wait for another life to do it all over again, and just wasting time. So you don't want to do that. You should know what samsara is like and get out as soon as you can. And with that faith, you get the energy. And the energy is stillness. The wisdom understands what virya means. A hero is not someone who does what everyone else does. A hero is sacrifices, lets go, renounces. So you renounce things. You renounce not just your possessions, you renounce your life, your controller, your doer, the thing which makes all the preferences, which wants, which argues, which thinks. That's the one you really want to renounce. Renounce all thoughts. If you could do that, you're on this jumbo jet to Nirvana. I was telling someone recently that that story which I wrote about, most of my life stories, I just wrote about at least the interesting ones anyway, not the boring ones. And most of the stories are boring ones, by the way. But that story about when I thought I was enlightened, and the pork curry story, which you all know, found out I wasn't enlightened after all. But the major insight which made me think I was enlightened was just seeing through the nature of thought. And just, it was so conditioned. I saw where it all came from, and I couldn't trust any of it. Not even the thought, which I just said. And it was wonderful when you couldn't trust any thought, any judgment, any idea, because you see it was completely conditioned, arbitrary, not founded on anything solid at all. I literally had nibbida towards that thinking process. I understand what nibbida was. What do I want to get involved in this for again? I can't trust it. None of it is valid. And because of that nibbida, you got viraga. The whole thing started to cease. It just faded away. And that's when I got incredibly still and just thoughts just couldn't come into my mind. And that's when you got really high, huge amounts of energy and bliss, and meditation was just so, so incredibly easy. Just close your eyes, you watch your breath, get beautiful breath and nimittas, the whole works really quickly. Simply because the thinking mind was just completely undermined. And of course I thought I was enlightened then. Only later on I found out it wasn't enlightenment. But it still was a powerful insight, which I always remember. It was just undermining thinking. Please do that at least in this range retreat, so that no longer will you trust all these thoughts and ideas which go in your mind and which torture you. If you do that, you've got a huge amount of punya, of wisdom. And that makes the path really, really easy. And fast as well. So thinking causes all the problems. Even those of you who are still in your 20s, you already thought too much in your whole life. And how many of your thoughts at the time you thought were correct? And later on you look back and thought they were absolutely wrong. Has that happened to you many times? You're absolutely certain you were correct. You look back later on and you find, no, I didn't see something. That's why your thoughts are always based on limited experience. And you should never trust them. So that way you can't get into any arguments. And you can't put value on any thought whatsoever. Even thoughts about Dhamma. Just they lose all their value. And then when you don't think about Dhamma, and all the thoughts disappear, then you see Dhamma instead of thinking and conceptualizing it. You just go to the real Dhamma, not the words, not the ideas, not the thoughts. It's what wisdom is. See where all the suttas come from. Now, what did the Buddha see that he could give such amazing talks? What exactly was he describing? And you actually can see that when your thinking stops, when you get very still and you come out the other side of a jhana. And you can do that. So have enough wisdom to stop the thinking mind. Don't give it any value whatsoever. And have enough mindfulness and reflection to understand what I mean. You look back on what you've just been thinking. What a complete waste of time that was. And even just that word, what a complete waste of time, that too was a waste of time. So in the end, the thoughts has got no ground to stand on. No alaya, no roosting place. You know that word alaya, I was explaining it in the Dharma class to the novices and anagarikas. You have Himalaya, alaya of the Hima, of the snows, Meghalaya, the alaya, the abode of the clouds. Buddha said the alaya of all the rivers in India was the ocean. That's where they hang out. So alaya is like the roosting where things hang out, where they go to, where they abide. Without giving any abode to thinking. No place where it can stand. No value. You find all the thinking stops. It becomes worthless. Just like a bunch of old junk. You just throw it out of your hut. You throw it out of your mind. What do I need this for? When you throw out all those thoughts, you have stillness. Wisdom just turns back and creates more stillness. More stillness creates more mindfulness. The mindfulness creates more energy. And the energy creates more faith. The indriyas turning back on themselves and creating this beautiful circle of the wisdom and the faith increasing so much that eventually that you have the unshakable faith, the avaccha pasada in the Buddha Dharma and the Sangha, which is called being a stream winner. You understand exactly what you're having faith in. And goes back again. Goes back again to create even stronger virya. This energy, this joy of being an Aryan. This great positive energy. Joy and happiness. If you ever see Aryas who are miserable, I can't understand how there can be Aryas and still be miserable. At least reflecting their stream, there's only 7 lifetimes left. Even if they're sort of not the quickest of areas. Still, that's enough to bliss them out. And the ability to attain deep meditation is just so much easier. So they should be really happy people. And that energy from stillness, leading to even more mindfulness, deeper samadhi, and more powerful wisdom. So the wisdom gets so strong that the seeds of rebirth are destroyed. Just like it said in the fire sermon, when you got nibbida, you see that none of this belongs to you. All these five senses, there's a mass of suffering. Then you have nibbida towards the eye forms, eye consciousness, and anything to do with eye consciousness, all that's felt and experienced with eye consciousness. You've had enough. Sights, ear, sound consciousness, anything to do with sound consciousness, all that's felt with this, you've had enough of. You're pissed off at the whole lot. It's never got you anywhere. You give it up. Everything to do with smell and taste consciousness. All your likes and dislikes of the palate. Been there, done that. You get nibbida to taste and to smells. Even taste consciousness. Anything to do with taste. You've had enough of. And even physical feeling. People should have had enough of that by now. Every one of you has been sick from time to time. Got backache, stomachache, sicknesses all over the body. But still we think, oh, I can sort of have some pleasure with this body. Find a nice girl or something. Have some sex, whatever. But you know, sometimes you think, why am I even bothered about that? And so you see that the body and the body consciousness, things to be felt with the body, everything, you just get nibbida towards, you've had enough. And then you get the real nice one, the mind and the mind objects. All your fantasies and thoughts, you just see that there's nothing there at all. And you get nibbida to all that, and all nibbida to all experience with the mind. When you get nibbida towards the mind sense, then the whole thing just, there's nothing left. The whole thing just disappears. You've had enough of samsara. It's what samsara is. The six senses, their playground. The five khandhas is what makes up this samsara. When you've had enough, then you understand what the path leads to. Until you've had enough, until you're delighting like a child playing with its dolls and with its little toy soldiers, or like a modern kid just messing around with video games, thinking how clever they are, they've got on to the ninth level. It's absolutely stupid. Waste of time. Once you realize how you waste your time, and you've penetrated through, you've had nibbida to the whole lot. And only then are you truly free. Free of samsara. Only then can you say, the seed, the interest in samsara has been uprooted. And because that fuel has been destroyed through anupadana, it's not through the lack of attachment, but through the absence of fuel. Then the asavas have been destroyed. Only then can you say, katang karaniyang. What had to be done has been done. There is no more of this. Only then can you say you're an arahat. You've done the job. Congratulations. You're out of samsara. So try and do that as quickly as possible, with as much fun as possible. And to be able to do that, lessen your defilements through mindfulness and reflection, and develop the five indriyas. See what the problem is and do something about it. And then you find you do get a fast and happy path all the way to nibbana. And that's what any monk would wish for you. And that's the talk this evening.